David A. Price presents...
Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 355. I'm your host, Steve Raker, conjuring up some seasonal fun down in the comic book bunker, my own personal laboratory. This episode's feature is our seventh Halloween-related installment of our Tomb of Dracula coverage. Jerry McDade has joined me over the years. We covered the first 21 issues of Tomb of Dracula in 2015 on Marvel Noise episodes 255 and 256. The next year through issue 31 on Marvel Noise episode 281. In 2017, we made it through issue 42 on episode 305. Then in 2018, episode 321 saw us cover the Doctor Strange crossover. Then last year in 2019 on episode 337, Jerry and I covered issues 45 through 50. And Jerry will be back this episode to cover issues 51 through 60. Now in our 14th year, Marvel Noise is the podcast proudly sponsored by nobody. You can stream and download episodes new and old over on marvelnoise.com. See images and give us feedback on our Facebook and Twitter pages. And listen to other fine shows on the Deliberate Noise Network, including Indie Comic Book Noise, our sister show where we talk about the indie books we've been digging on. And don't forget to check out BaltimoreComicCon.com to see what the events the 2020 Baltimore Comic Con will be putting on online. Before I get Jerry on, also in the spirit of the season, I've been reading Marvel Zombies Resurrection, written by my pal Philip Kennedy Johnson, with art by Leonard Kirk. This four-issue limited series, three issues of which have come out, and the prelude one-shot that was out in March or April, maybe, just as the publishing hiatuses were hitting. Great issue, great artwork. It really drove me into being intrigued about this take on the Marvel zombies. I mean, you know, it's a trap gig, right, for the writer? Marvel zombies have been done over and over in the last 15 years or so. And kudos to Kennedy Johnson for weaving an all-new narrative. At first, I found it to be an awkward time shift in the first issue of the limited series. You think you're going to follow the initial infection event that was covered in the one-shot issue, but most of this series actually takes place years after the prelude issue. By moving forward in time and focusing on a small group of characters, it makes for a much more intimate, relatable, and entertaining tale that I can't wait to see how it finishes. The story focuses on Spider-Man, who was charged with protecting Franklin and Valeria Richards when the initial infection wave was rushing over the superhumans and humanity in general on Earth. And Spidey, Franklin, and Valeria are joined by Moonstone, Forge, and a reprogrammed Sentinel that they call Nana. Peter just wants to keep the kids alive, but they want to find the Galactus-based source of the zombie infection and try to cure their parents, and maybe even Johnny. This mission takes them to locales across the Marvel Universe, the X-Mansion in the first issue, a robot colony that's developed in the second, and Atlantis in the third. Every issue, Peter keeps having these like horrific dreams of the Fantastic Four getting a hold of the kids and biting Franklin, even while thanking him for watching over them all these years. It's really creepy. And then when it turns out to be not so much a dream, but a memory, it's like double creepy. I like the whole idea of the time shift giving the characters distance from the Marvel Universe that we know. this is a ragtag group of folks just trying to survive here, and they've lost touch with what it means to be a hero. Who do you protect when all you're trying to do is protect yourself? How do you find what it means to be a hero again? I mean, this is a real Peter Parker moral conscious, you know, wrestling with his instinct to just protect the kids and hide, and his responsibility to maybe affect things. We'll see. Like I said, I can't wait to see how it finishes up. I'm also loving the weekly publishing schedule, especially after waiting so long since the setup issue last spring. So, fantastic, entertaining, Marvel Zombies have been resurrected in more ways than one. From 2020, we're going to go all the way back to 1976 next. Let me get generous Jerry McDade on. Jerry, welcome back to the show, my friend. I'm so excited because it's time to get back to covering chunks of the Tomb of Dracula series, as we've done for the last 6 years now on Halloween.
Unbelievable. You keep inviting me back and I don't get it, but here I am.
We're going to get through this thing. I'm telling you, the story is I never read this stuff when I was a kid. I was like 5, 6, 7 years old when this series ran and ended. So I only had pulled a few issues off the racks, most notably the ones that crossed over with Marvel characters like the Silver Surfer one and the Doctor Strange one. And if I'm not mistaken, you haven't read this stuff either, right?
That is right. Yeah, I was just a little babe in the woods, like baby Janice. Spoilers. I never...
In all the years since, shouldn't we have, though? I mean, we're pretty well read. This is a legendary series by creators who we've read most of their other works, probably. Between the two of us, I'm sure we've read all of their other works.
Yeah.
And here this series has been sitting there just waiting, nice and sophisticated for guys our age now to delve into and check out.
I think we were waiting until we were worthy. That's all it was. We wanted to be worthy. 6 years ago, we deemed ourselves worthy, and here we are. God help us all.
A lot of this Bronze Age silliness, though, I think it was easier to look over when we were younger, though. Like, sure. Looking back at it now, it really stands out that some of the deals that the previous editors-in-chief, like, remember in the 70s, Marvel had all these short-lived editors-in-chief. It was like a rotating door. No one wanted the job until Shooter came along. And Marv Wolfman was one of them, and the deal kind of with each of the successive ones is that the previous one, if he was still writing for Marvel, was able to edit his own book.
Right.
So, you know, that can lead to some real creative freedom.
Yes. But
there's also times where it's like, you know, Marv, you need an editor, my friend.
Yeah. Yeah.
But these issues are written by Marv Wolfman, with pencils by Gene Colan, and inks, and for the most part, colors by Tom Palmer. And we're covering Tomb of Dracula 51-60 that ran from fall of 1976 into the summer of 1977.
Good times.
You can read these books in reprint form in the Tomb of Dracula omnibus hardcovers, in the Marvel Unlimited digital service app thing, and in the old phone books, the Marvel Essentials. This chunk of issues, well, it continues to develop the situations and themes that we introduced the last time, way back on Marvel Noise 337. Dracula's at large, in and around Boston, Massachusetts, and he's set up shop in this old, desecrated, like, ruins of a castle or abandoned church. It's kind of a cross between the two, and the place is great. It's roomy, maybe a little drafty, and smartly decorated.
Yes, a wonderful collection of art for any aspiring Satanist.
There's a portrait of Christ, an oil painting that Dracula can't remove, and it occasionally mocks him from afar with this, like these not just gazing eyes, but like light comes forth from them.
Such is the power of the Lord, Steve. Not even a word need be said.
Dracula has allowed himself to play the role of the Dark Lord for this satanic cult that's led by Anton Lipinski. And only Lipinski knows that Dracula is actually a vampire and not Satan himself. Part of the deal is that Dracula is to be given a woman, Domini, to be his wife and to sire Drac's child, which intrigued Dracula, and he's playing along while Lipinski plots to rid his cult of Drac and for the child to be like the dark messiah that he can manipulate and control. Our cast, the Drac Pack, or the Scoobies, are Frank Drake, who, he's a legitimate descendant of Dracula, but it's from Dracula's first wife, and Dracula hates his first wife, Jerry.
Hated her.
Then there's Rachel von Helsing, who's like a vampire huntress with a crossbow. Quincy Harker, who's the son of the original Dracula hunters, but he himself is now an old dude confined to a wheelchair, but with missiles.
Heck yeah.
Hannibal King, who's a reluctant vampire detective. Blade, who's like a para-vampire. His mother was killed while he was like in utero giving birth, and like he hunts vampires now, and he's quasi-vampiric.
I mean, if you have to explain who Blade is, what are we even doing here?
True.
Blade is the man, and that's all you need to know. If it wasn't for Blade, I don't even know that I could have made it through these issues.
And there's Harold J. Harold, who's an introverted, nerdy guy who writes about vampires for a tabloid in Boston. And when we last left our cast, Harold J. Harold and Frank Drake were discovered infiltrating Lupinski's cult, and Rachel von Helsing shows up on the scene to rescue them, and Dracula has now also appeared, so they're all confronting each other. Rachel gets a crossbow bolt off and hits Dracula in the chest, but misses his heart so he can take it.
Oh, man.
She demands safe passage for her, Drake, and Harold, and despite not holding any cards, Dracula acquiesces.
He's a gentleman like that.
They make their escape, and he lets them go, except for one rogue satanist follows them.
Never be the one guy from a crowd that runs after everybody, because if you do, you might be the one that catches a bolt to the butt.
Clear in the butt, like it was a bullseye.
I want to know how he ends up in this kneeling, butt-facing position. It's like he's inviting this shot, and she shoots him right in the pooper.
Maybe he was going to, like, moon them leaving, like, and don't come back, you know?
Yeah, that's probably what it was. And, yeah, I guess the Knights of the Round Table should have considered something like this.
When the gang gets back to Quincy Harker's, they find him unconscious. He's had another heart attack. They got to call an ambulance and everything. Dracula gets Lipinski to pull out the bolt. The one in his chest, not the one in the other guy's butt.
It's still good.
Then he heads off to a posh Boston fundraiser for his, well, it's Anton Lipinski's church. They're going to recruit from Boston's wealthy and elite. Dracula makes this grand appearance with his wife, Domini. He's trying to build resources and assets for his bid to take over the world. When questioned, he uses his hypnotic powers to kind of draw them all into his ranks. Dracula gets unnerved, though, and it's unusual to see him this way when he sees someone familiar, you know, watching from the shadows. So Dracula pounces, but no one is there.
What?
Someone he's seen in other times, in other countries. Meanwhile, Blade and Hannibal King have been on the trail of the powerful vampire who sired King and killed Blade's mother, causing her to go into labor with him and you know, is the catalyst for his vampiric powers. And he's a fella named Deacon Frost. No relation to Emma. Or was there? Who knows? While on Frost's trail, the pair encounter a totally vampy twin of Blade. And Blade and Vamp Blade, like, fought. And the vampire Blade won, assimilating, like, quite literally absorbing our Blade in the process. It was really weird.
This was the trippiest thing that happened in the 51 issues that we've read to this point. No real explanation how this works that makes any sense. I just decided to go with it. I'll just go with it.
In this issue, Blade, the bad Blade, is chasing King down the street. King manages to stab Blade in the throat with a piece of broken fence, and then suddenly remembers a tip on Frost's whereabouts and crashes Dracula's party with Blade right behind him. Dracula attacks Blade as soon as he sees him. What are you doing here? But he's surprised to see that there's fang marks on his neck that are, you know, created by Deacon Frost, who's in attendance at the party. King chases Frost, but he flutters away as a bat. Vamp Blade and Drac continue to tussle. Blade's pretty good. He stabs Dracula with a stake, but he misses his heart. Second time today, Jerry.
You know, if the guy just had some more emotion, the heart might have been a hittable target, but it's just too small. His heart is too small.
Dracula pulls out the stake and returns the favor, but he doesn't miss, and Blade is dead.
Ooh. He gets better.
Lepesky has a secret talk with Domini and tries to make a deal with her. He's like, you know, help me get rid of Dracula, and then she can rule the church through her Messiah of the Sun. But, you know, he'll be influencing her, so he'll really be ruling everything.
Of course.
She says no, but she also won't rat him out and tells him so. She's got her own plans, which is pretty cryptic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that I think that is probably the strongest part of this arc is her part of it. You know, that is the best mystery of the whole deal, I think.
How can you marry Dracula, for Pete's sake?
Right.
What's the deal with this chick? I love the weird cover of issue 52. Dracula's riding in the front car of a roller coaster while holding a terrified female victim in his arms, while a long-haired, golden-skinned guy looking like a acrobat from the Cirque du Soleil in white spandex is leaping towards them, and Drac is recoiling in fear from that.
You know, I am still a little upset, even days after reading this, because as this golden guy is leaping at Dracula on the cover, and Dracula screams, "It's him," in my head, I think Adam Warlock.
Totally. Right?
And I was all excited. I was sure this was Adam Warlock.
They both have golden skin.
Right.
He calls him a couple of times, and I felt the same way. Like, it's him. No, it's not him. Why isn't it him?
At this point, he was already going by Adam Warlock, wasn't he? 76? I think.
Yeah, just about, right? I mean, not for long. Interesting.
This matters 40 years later.
This issue opens with the Drac Pack burying Blade. Even Saffron is there. Of course Saffron's there. What am I saying?
Oh, she's sad.
The rest of the issue focuses on Dracula being thwarted by this mysterious but familiar to Dracula figure. It starts when Dracula visits Blade's grave to gloat, and then it's like, it is he, the guy from the party, the one who has haunted me all these past centuries. Like, Drac is freaking out. Then he recalls past times that he's encountered this being, both being times that he thwarted Dracula's plans to overthrow a country. The first time, it was before Dracula was even a vampire. Centuries ago, as a ruler of this small province in Spain, he is stopped inexplicitly from... inexplicitly?
No, it was very explicit. We can't talk about it on this podcast, but just read the book, you'll see.
He's stopped from executing a dissenter who's loyal to the king. And then years later, when Dracula led a vampire army to take over Vienna, they reach the throne room and Dracula takes one look inside and retreats. It's like, who is this guy? So Dracula decides to catch a movie.
Now this scene, just to set, this is quintessential Tomb of Dracula.
I love this scene.
You got like the baddest guy on the block, who is so emotionally weak and insecure and fickle, and he just can't decide what his emotions are at any given moment. And it all plays out in this scene, I think.
He decides he's going to go catch a movie and see Dracula that is starring Louis Belsky, which is a reference to the Dracula Lives short-lived Marvel black and white magazine that was on the stands at the time these issues came out.
Aha.
He's in Dracula Lives #4 as an actor who, you know, with the name's a play on Bela Lugosi, obviously.
Right.
Dracula keeps getting annoyed by the crowd in the movie because they're like, you know, down in front, big guy, and that kind of stuff. So he kills a lady, like, in front of everybody and sends the crowd running and then is like, where'd everybody go? I didn't even want, you know, any violence here tonight.
And all that after a kid offered him popcorn and everything.
Well, you know, he likes extra butter, I guess. This dude looks like he's extra buttered when he shows up.
He's like Kramer in that episode of Seinfeld.
Oh, God.
He's butter for tanning oil.
This time he's dressed like Steranko, honestly.
And he
reveals that it's his mission to stop Dracula from becoming a conqueror of nations. He works for a higher power, and Drac assumes that he means Satan because he's posing as the Dark Lord at Lupeski's church. But, you know, to you and me, it's pretty obvious that he means the guy upstairs.
Right.
Which, I mean, that means this golden-skinned, white-haired clown is an angel?
Yeah.
I mean, looks... Oh, wow. Oh, man. All right.
Was just trying to throw you off the scent.
Yeah, he looks like Jor-El, for Pete's sake. Well, this guy, oh man, he can easily handle Dracula's attacks. He's got lots of light emanating from him that repels Dracula.
And, just like the devil would.
And weird teleportation power. Like, he teleports their battle to center stage at a circus with a full crowd present. Then he compels Dracula's flying, fleeing form to the roller coaster from the cover, where they stand right on the cars while it's going and they tussle over, you know, like the car's filled with people. They're terrified right underneath them. Dracula realizes that this guy has more than enough power to handle him, so he tries his hypnotic powers. They don't work either.
Oh, man. He's running out of tricks.
But they do work on the crowd, right?
Yes.
I mean, so he enchants the crowd and forces them to attack each other in a chaotic mob. So then the angel dude has to choose either fight Dracula or let him escape while he tries to save the crowd.
Yeah, devil guy, you want to save all these innocent people, right, devil?
So while he saves the crowd, Dracula stabs him in the back. Take that, demon. It's then that he reveals he's not a demon, that he works for the other guy. Then, this is my favorite part, then his discorporeal spirit form rises, and Dracula chases him, and as they get, it's like, you know, hearing the sirens, and you're driving home, and you're getting closer and closer, and you realize that, like, the sirens are at your house. No. Dracula chases the spirit all the way back to his castle lair, and it lands right behind Domini into the picture of Christ.
No!
That same heavenly light shines from Christ's eyes, and it's the light that this dude was shining at him all afternoon.
There's a song in here somewhere.
Well, listen, things get really jitterbugging in issue 53. Hannibal King says so right on the splash page. I mean, in this issue, they promise to finally get to all the lingering Deacon Frost stuff. And we first saw him way back in Tomb of Dracula number 13 that we covered on Marvel Noise 256. The cover, too, I should mention, it has some art alterations by Marie Severin. And if you look there, you're like, oh, yeah, that actually isn't exactly Tom Palmer's inks, is it?
Hmm.
So Hannibal King has a great idea. He recruits Damien Hellstrom, the son of Satan, to exhume Blade's body. The procedure is surprisingly simple, right? You pull the stake out, which brings Blade back to life, but he's bad Blade. Then Hellstorm. See what I did there? Because he's Hellstorm when he's wearing the cape.
Mm.
And he's Hellstrom when he's wearing his civvies.
Oh, no, I get it.
So then Hellstorm uses Soulfire to separate the real and the doppelganger Blades. Then they just restake the bad Blade, leaving the good one. Easy peasy.
Well, they should keep this guy around more. You know, they're like, okay, thanks for fixing our problem. See you later. Maybe invite him to stick around.
This is the 70s where he was one of the new characters and all. I like that, you know, he fit in to this world as a, you know, as someone might call upon Doctor Strange when there's a magic problem or something. These guys, you know, they don't have Doctor Strange's number, but.
Yeah, I'll admit, when he shows up at the beginning of this issue, it was probably the funnest part of the whole thing for me. Just because, you know, a new face introduced, maybe he'll do some cool stuff, but too short.
Dracula's only appearance in this issue is an 8-panel sequence where he leaves Domini to rest, because, I mean, she's 8 months pregnant at this point. And he flies off to claim a victim and feed, but bails on the first one because she's a mother?
Yeah.
I mean, he never used to care about that.
Yeah.
So he settles on a black guy.
Yeah.
Also, he cryptically states that he has a special task for him once he turns and awakens. Then the resurrected Blade gets reunited with Saffron. But King didn't bring him back to life to see that all over again, right? So remember when he had to hang out for like hours while they were getting reunited?
It feels so good.
So they head out and they infiltrate Deacon Frost's underground lair, because King actually followed him when he fled Dracula's party a few issues ago, which was all off-panel, but I guess it wasn't the biggest dough when he flew away after all.
Aha.
Also, I thought it was funny when they go to Frost's headquarters, one of their, you know, timely pop culture comments is that it looks like a set right out of Hammer Films, right? Which made all those low-budget horror movies and B-horror movies in the 70s.
Right.
But I think it's funny that they mention Hammer Film, because in that Dracula Lives book, the black and white mag, where that Louis Belsky guy was the actor, he worked for Mallet Films, which seemed like it was the Tomb of Dracula, you know, equivalent.
Yeah.
And it's funny that they wouldn't mention, I guess we wouldn't get the reference Mallet, but it's funny that I guess Hammer and Mallet both exist in this world.
That's awesome.
And Wolfman wrote them both, too.
Oh, that was going to be my question. Okay.
Hannibal King explains that Deacon Frost was originally is basically a mad scientist who whipped up an immortality serum from the blood of a vampire. Then he gets accidentally injected with his own serum.
Whoops.
Turns into a pseudo-vampire, kind of like Morbius. But he has this weird effect where every time he bites someone, he creates a dupe that he controls. So he's built a vampire army of blades and kings.
I think it's probably a good idea to keep Jamie Madrox away from this guy. I don't even know what would happen.
Right? King and Blade fight their way through the horde of duplicates of themselves, trying to land killing blows while at the same time trying to absorb making any kind of contact that would make them get absorbed, you know? It's a difficult element to have to deal with in a close quarters melee.
Very.
Then they chase Frost to his lab, where they throw knives at him from a distance before he can throw his own projectile, which was a jar of deadly fungus. Thank God that didn't land. Frost falls back into his own lab equipment, and the place goes up in flames and explodes, just as King and Frost escape. The issue ends with Blade and Saffron riding off into the sunset on a bus to Minneapolis. And that's the story of how Hannibal, King, and Blade finally got their revenge on Deacon Frost, the vampire who turned King into a vampire and killed Blade's mother. Years of build-up for that Jerry, that confrontation right there.
Once they could get him in a room, they made short work of him. It was a little anticlimactic. You got to wonder why it was so hard.
If he had landed that jar of deadly fungus, though.
Oh, I guess I didn't consider that. Yeah.
Issue 54 is titled, "Twas the Night Before Christmas," because it's Christmas Eve, and she's going to give birth at any minute. What's funny is she insists on giving birth at their castle church home, even though Dracula doesn't want to because of, you know, that painting. She convinces him that it's where the ritual that allowed her to conceive with him was held, so that's really where the birth needs to be. The Drac Pack is gathered around the recovering Quincy Harker, who's caught wind of the news that Dracula has taken a wife and impregnated her, and she's going to give birth tonight on Christmas Eve as some sort of blasphemous parody of Christ's own birth. Rachel Von Helsing sneaks off on her own, crossbow in hand, to take out Dracula, and then ultimately the gang goes after her. She encounters Lupesky and forces him to lead her to the birth site, and he's like, you know, sure, as long as you kill him so that I don't have to, you know?
Yeah.
Dracula is pissed when Rachel shows up, though. She repels him with a cross, but he turns into fog and sneaks up on her and knocks her out and everything. Lupesky chains her up. Then, to protect Domini and hide from further intrusions, he opts to move to the stable in the back. You know, see what they're doing here, Jerry?
I see it.
Rachel manages to get a flare signal off, although she almost dislocates her wrist trying to do it. She's got like a special crossbow bolt that was a flare. The flares work. She promptly gets rescued by the gang, and they go and present themselves to Dracula and fight.
They were fortunately driving around in a snowstorm in a convertible with the top down, and they were able to see the flare.
Man, are my feet cold. Domini gives birth during the tussle. Dracula hears the cries and orders the Drac Pack to leave, allowing them to do so unharmed because of the momentous event. The baby, though, Jerry? It's black. Blade! Nah, just kidding. But he is golden-skinned and red-eyed like that angel dude.
Hmm.
Uh-oh. Well, The plot doesn't really move forward too much over either of the next two issues, although 56 being an imaginary fairy tale is more of a true filler issue, with issue 55 providing some pretty interesting character moments between Dracula and Domini and Dracula and Lupescu that embellish kind of where these characters are at now and how they got there. Domini wants Dracula to come look at his baby, which he can barely do, Jerry. He's like, why is his skin so golden? You know? The only conclusion is too horrendous to consider. He sees it right in front of him and he can't deal. Before presenting the newborn to his followers, Dracula explains to Lupescu that, you know, hypnotized people act like thralls on his every whim. They're unable to function effectively on their own, so Dracula seeks willful followers to help conquer the world. And using Lupescu's church, he will ensnare the ensnarable, and in that way build up followers and conquer. This makes Lupescu not blink his eyes for four panels. And he decides he needs to move up the timetable and get Dracula out of the picture even sooner.
Right. You know, as a villain, I think for those who aren't going to ever bother reading this, Lupescu is more terrifying to look at than Dracula. He is a truly creepy looking dude.
Totally.
It's hard to tell sometimes if he's, you know, if he's got scarification on his face or he's just skeletal or what. He's just creepy. I don't like him.
The whole thing of Dracula using religion to conquer the masses is quite a commentary on, like, the function of religion and its effect on society and stuff.
Amen, Steve.
For those without hypnotic powers, it's the way that men control the minds of others, as Dracula puts it. But it's funny because at the same time as Wolfman is saying that, right, he's also pretty much confirming the existence of like a heavenly father who is good.
Yes.
And trying to protect the world from any time Dracula makes a blip on his radar. So that's a weird, you know, the existence of angels and everything, that's a weird balancing act.
Yeah.
But whatever, it's comics.
Well, I think the people that are making the skeptical statements are the villains.
True.
Right? And the good guys tend to be more religious. So, I don't know. Maybe that's... I don't know. Wolfman doesn't strike me as particularly religious himself, but it's compelling story making, you know?
Are you trying to say that writers can say things through the mouths of their characters that they themselves don't believe at all?
I'm not walking into that trap. Let's hurry up and get along with this so we can get to the next panel, because I want to talk about the final appearance of Aurora, who's been missing for I don't know how many issues, to the point where I thought she had been written out of the book. And she's like one of my favorite characters. And she's sporting this super cool t-shirt that I gotta have. It's got like a bat symbol on it, like a Batman symbol, and it's red, and it says Gumball inside. I don't know what that is. I just know I want it. How do I get it?
Another great comic book redhead, right?
They're all great. She's no exception.
Yeah, I looked, there's a band Gumball, but they formed like in the 80s, so they weren't around then. So it's like, I don't know. It seems like a attempt at a logo of some kind. I don't know what it is. It is pretty cool, though.
Maybe we should check their merch site on GeoCities. See if we can still find it.
During the presentation of the newborn child to the cult, where he's named Janus, which is a fitting name because that's the Greek god of transitions, of doorways, beginnings and endings, and is often depicted having two faces. Lupescu lays this whole Messiah angle on pretty heavy. And Dracula realizes he's trying to steal Dracula's, like, power in like his place in the church and shifted over to the child that he thinks that he can control.
Yeah.
Shrek ain't having that. He interrupts. He states his claim as Lord, Master, and Ruler round here and all that. And now the party's over. Everybody go home.
You can almost hear the eye rolls in the crowd. Like, yeah, we know what's up. Your day's done.
Dracula and Domini talk in private over the next 5 pages, where he reiterates his love for her, unlike his first wife, who he hates above all others.
Mm-hmm.
And he explains his only other offspring is Lilith, who was his daughter, who despises him as much as he does her.
Foreshadowing.
Domini tells him that she grew up isolated in a convent, and that meeting Lupescu with his satanic cult and everything allowed her to, like, run off and join the circus, basically. Like, it was a way to get out and to rebel against her upbringing.
Yeah.
She ultimately, though, found herself just as trapped in the cult, unable to leave, sharing blood and, well, presumably other body fluids.
Right.
She was a thing to be abused, to be stepped on, to be hurt. Jeez. When she gets told that she was to be the bride of Satan, she was like, yeah, whatever, but now she truly loves him, heart and soul. What's with this chick, Jerry?
I don't know. I mean, he's got those eyes. She's not the first. She's not the first. She won't be the last.
Meanwhile, Lupescu is having 30 silver bullets forged to give to Harker and the gang so that they can take Dracula out.
Yeah, one for each of his tiny hearts.
His treachery is observed by an agent of Dracula, though. And it's the guy from issue 53 who is Drac's second choice when he aborted feeding on the lady who was a mother. Except now he's not black.
Right.
Like, not at all.
Dang, he's not. I guess I didn't bother going back to try to figure out who he was. I had already forgotten, and I would have never made that connection.
Both the inker, who didn't ink his features black, and the colorist, who didn't color him black, got it wrong. Same guy, right? Tom Palmer.
How dare he? Next time I see him, I'm going to throw this in his face. Demand answers. We'll see how that goes.
It's so funny. Have I told you that I have this funny relationship with Tom Palmer, where I have seen him at a couple of cons here and there over the years, right? And then started seeing him in Baltimore. And maybe the second year in a row of seeing him in Baltimore, I rode the elevator with him and said hello to him. And he said hello to me. And it was kind of like acting like someone who has Alzheimer's and he thinks he should know who I am, so he immediately turns on, like, the friendliness, how you been, you know, that kind of thing, like, in a familiar kind of a way, which was so funny, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, I see him at his table again over the weekend, and, hey, how are you, Tom? And then every year since then, I say hello to him, and he, you know, he warmly greets me.
So that's the trick. I just got to get in elevators with these guys.
Heck of a painter.
Yeah, he's awesome. He's a card.
This vampire who was black and now isn't goes to tell Dracula, but he finds Domini instead and tells her, you know, I'll relay the message, but...
Yeah.
Who knows? There's something weird.
She holds the little angel baby. You get the feeling that the signal might not be passed along.
But yet she professes her love, you know? She's hard to figure out. Outside, there's a raging snowstorm. Domine bundles up Janice and treks out in a husky-pulled snow sled over the river and through the woods to Lupescu's house they go. She wants to discuss something with him.
Now, I've never been to Boston, but I just want to know, anybody who's from Boston or has been spent any time in Boston, if you were to see a dog sled going down the middle of the street in Boston, would you think twice about it? Or do you just see that all the time?
They must be outside of Boston.
Yeah, that's it.
Where the abandoned castles are.
Yes.
Issue 56 is a filler issue, like I mentioned. It's Harold J. Harold sitting down at his typewriter and cranking out his masters. The Vampire Conspiracy. It's a total ego trip.
I think he would say he was crapping it out.
Yeah. he goes on full ego here. He's in charge of the Drac Pack. You know, Frank Drake couldn't even tie his shoes if it wasn't for Harold, you know.
Right.
Aurora loves him. Dracula fears him. You get the idea. He even faces Dracula mano a mano and comes up of the victor at the end.
Right.
But in the real end, he turns in his draft of the book to Aurora, but she's got no time for him. Biff Rifkin is waiting in his sedan for their date.
Yeah. You know, this issue, I think this probably would have been the most enjoyable issue for me if they did anything kind of interesting, you know, an interesting twist on this trope.
Right.
But it really wasn't that interesting until that last page where he bombs out asking her on a date and she blows him off. And then, like, you really feel sympathy for the guy that just has to write his own stories where he can be a hero, because he'll never be one in real life.
That's probably some meta commentary by Wolfman too, as far as that life of the writer, or the way that the writer views himself versus what he's able to, you know, accomplish on paper and stuff.
Yeah.
And it's funny that, you know, I immediately reading this issue, I think of the classic fairy tale X-Men, you know, Kitty with the dragon and all that.
Yeah.
But that, you know, that was years later. This came out many years prior. That I don't know how much of a trope it was to do these kinds of fantasy stories within a story back then. I mean, maybe some in the Silver Age and some of the crazy DC stuff where it's like everything was an imaginary tale, but
yeah, that's fair.
Issues 57 and 58 are both pretty solid standalone issues before the bat hits the fan in 59 and 60. 57 sports an uncredited Gil Kane Tom Palmer cover. Who can really see the Kane underneath all that Palmer, though, right?
I love this cover.
Quincy's shooting his wheelchair rockets. I mean, it never gets old.
Uh-uh.
This tale, The Forever Man, tells the story of Gideon Smith, a guy with a moon scar on his cheek, who in 1792 is told by an Indian mystic that he will live forever, continually being reincarnated if he dies, which is shown over and over and over again until he's a guy living in modern times in Boston. The mystic, though, he also said that death by Dracula was the only way to really break the reincarnation chain. So avoid Dracula at all costs, you know?
Absolutely.
Which he manages to do over the centuries until he gets hit by a drunk driver in that blasted never-ending snowstorm and gets rushed to Boston General Hospital, where I did some volunteer OT coursework there in the mid-90s.
Oh, hey.
And I repeatedly saw the patients would be brought in by husky-driven snow sleds.
Oh, okay. Well, I feel better now.
You know what I'm thinking, too? When was the big Boston blizzard of, was it 77? That might be, but they probably, this stuff would have been written prior to. But it would be interesting, the timing, because Boston obviously was famous for quite some time for that big blizzard at that time.
78.
Ah, okay. So this was the catalyst for that. caused it.
Yeah, I think it like a butterfly flapping its wings.
They're like, we want to see huskies pulling snow sleds through the streets of Boston. Let's go. Make it happen. Dracula is out hunting because he hungers. He spots a victim. He feeds, but is spotted by the cops. he quickly is able to dispose of one officer and then chases after another to a brownstone, where Dracula is stuck by the old vampire rule, you can't go in unless you get invited in.
Yeah.
It's very Three Little Pigs. He's like, let me in so I can kill you. And the guy's like, well, actually, he lets him in. He doesn't have to, but
he does.
But he's armed with a cross and scars Dracula's face horribly, so horribly that he staggers out of the building and just collapses in the snow, where a little old nun finds him and brings him to Boston General. So he's like laying there in a hospital bed, faced all bandaged up, and his roommate, Gideon Smith, the Forever Man.
Unbelievable.
So when the doctors unbandage Dracula and find his face perfectly healed, Gideon recognizes him and freaks out like, he is here to kill me. But Dracula kills his two doctors instead.
Good place to start.
Dracula heads out into the take that. That's for my copayment. Dracula heads out into the corridor of the hospital to make his leave of this place, but runs into Rachel, Frank, and Quincy. Quincy's now back in his chair with the darts.
So is he just being released at this point from his heart attack?
I would suppose either that or he could be out for a walk, but you know, they could be pushing him for, you know, around just to get him up and out, but I would assume he was being discharged, I would hope. Although maybe a little too soon, because he gets as excited as I did when he shoots those darts out of the thing that he has another heart attack.
Well, Steve, if you're going to do it, the hospital is the place to do it.
This allows Dracula to retreat back to his room, where now he's going to take his anger out on Gideon, his roommate, who has caused all this ruckus in the first place. But that nun shows up. It's like the nun out of Daredevil or something. It's like she shows up and she's got her crucifix, sends Dracula out the window in bat form, which is probably how he should have left the room in the first place.
Right.
The issue ends with a 5-panel sequence where the doctors are reluctant to accept the existence of vampires despite what they've seen, and Gideon Smith is shown, I guess he's like in a kind of a catatonic state.
Yeah. And his beard has gone white.
Yeah, his eyes are opened. The doctors are like, it's like he's seen his own death and knows it's waiting for him. And waiting. And waiting. Oh, dun, dun, dun. Yeah. Forever. And ever. And ever. And so on. Issue 58 is primarily a Blade solo tale. Although the Drac Pack is briefly seen, giving Blade intel and setting him up for his mission. And I don't think Dracula even makes an appearance other than a 1-panel flashback. Here, Blade's old friend Musenda, who we actually met in issue 30 that we covered back on Marvel Noise 281. He was one of a group of folks who killed Dracula in China, and maybe it was like the 50s or something like that. Well, Musenda now needs Blade's help. His wife has been turned into a partial dusk-to-dawn vampire, and the only way to restore her is to kill the vampire who sired her. They smartly release this vamp wife and then track her. Quincy gave him this, cool little vampire tracking device that actually works.
Tricorder, let's just say. It's a tricorder.
Blade almost kills Musenda, though, when he's just totally reckless driving this motorcycle. There's not even any, they haven't encountered the bad guys or anything, and he drives off a cliff and into the drink.
Right.
They have to go and lick their wounds. Let's try that again, you know? And then they swim to a lighthouse, and it's all secret agent-like. They find Musenda's wife, and Blade accidentally stabs her dead. But no worries, Blade has some experience with this. We'll just pull it out later and she'll be fine.
That's how that works.
They bring her back to Saffron's and they do, and she is.
With the assistance of a stopwatch.
It's all about timing. the wife siring vamp shows up with a mad on because they keep messing with this vampire that she made. And she threatens to turn Saffron into a vampire. And it's like, nobody, like, Blade opens up a can of whoop-ass and saves everyone as soon as Saffron's threatened.
Mm-hmm.
The Drac Pack are locking and loading their firearms to go after Dracula when issue 59 opens. And wow, has Hannibal King really let himself go there or what? And then I was like, oh, that's Lupescu. I thought it was Hannibal King at first, and I was like, oh man, colon. But Lupescu is there with them, hair colored the same as King's, and he's brought them 30 silver pieces to betray Christ. I mean, 30 silver bullets to kill Dracula once and for all.
Oh, man, Steve, you drew that line between those two things so nicely.
And in this opening panel, too, I like in the back, you can see Saint the Dog's, like, throne chair. That's style right there.
I love the backgrounds that he draws in these books. They're like, I could get lost in these pages. You know, it's been worth the adventure just for the art. It really has been.
70s style is weird enough on its own, but then when you try to mix in like these old gothic things, and you know, it does make for it, this book, if anything, it totally puts you in a mood when you start reading it, right? It really is a world that you step into. It's like a cartoon where it's like we control the vertical and we control the horizontal, and it's just a moody book.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I don't love the writing. It's pretty repetitive, but despite that, I just, like, it just puts me in such a great place. It's the perfect fall read. It really is just awesome atmospherically. Love it.
The Drac Pack is uneasy about playing their role as pawns in Lupescu's plan. But hey, they do want to kill Drac, and Quincy's not getting any younger. Dracula feeds on a college lecturer who's being sexually harassed by a student after class.
Right. Yeah, the old saved by someone you probably didn't want to be saved by bit.
Yep. Although he really tries to empower her, though, Jerry. After murdering her.
Oh, you're going to like this, though. Isn't that what the last guy said before you chased him off?
Totally. But he tells her to turn her assailant into a vampire the next time he comes on to her. That'll teach him.
It will.
Anyway, that night at Dracula's celebration feast for Janice, the Drac Pack crash the party, and Lupescu is the first to shoot Dracula with a silver bullet, and it hurts. Harold hits Dracula. Quincy hits Dracula. But before Rachel can hit him, he turns fog and all the bullets just fall right out of him. Which is a good trick. He should have done that all those issues ago when he walked around for 30 pages with that dart in his arm.
Yes.
Still my favorite moment of Tomb of Dracula. Except maybe those Dr. Sun issues. Those were cool.
Yeah.
Lupescu's next shot goes right through the evaporating Dracula and strikes and instantly kills baby Janice.
Oh, no.
Dracula correctly blames Lupescu for this entire attack. And over 10, count them, 10 horrific panels, he crushes Lupescu's head. Crush your head. Crush your head.
Oh, man, this is great imagery, too. As he leaps on him, he kind of half transforms. His face transforms into like this demon bat face. It's so cool.
Yep.
You know he mad.
Dominie, dead infant in her arms, addresses the glowing portrait of Christ, stating something to the effect of knowing this was to be Janice's fate all along, but why do so many others have to die and all that stuff? She wants no more death, so she demands Dracula to allow the Scoobies to leave unharmed again.
Whose side is she on anyway?
I don't know, Jerry. I don't know. Once alone, Dracula is like, woman, you shouldn't be ordering vampires around. And she's like, it's not me, it's him. And she points to the painting. But then she again professes her love for Dracula, and it seems pretty sincere. And then follows right up with begging him to embrace both her and accept the word of Christ. Which he can't do.
I mean, he could. He just chose not to. What would happen? What do you think would happen if he did?
He would burn. He would turn to ashes, I would think. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, just... he can't even look at a crucifix. And I'm thinking this is, you know, at the end of this whole scene that we've been building up to, I mean, Lupescu's plan didn't exactly pan out, did it?
No, it was a trash fire.
His Dark Messiah died. He died. Dracula lives. Issue 60 is the last that we'll cover on this episode with, I like this cover a lot too, In the Rain by Gene Colan and Dave Simmons inks. I always liked Dave Simmons a lot.
Yeah.
Like a real lot. Like I really liked his Ghost Rider. Good stuff. When he laid the ink on thick, I really liked it. Like when you could tell it was Dave Simmons. You can't really hear because it's hard to, you know, it's Colan. It's hard to ink Colan. But he does it nice. I think it was more the colorist that had trouble here, which I'm guessing in the late 70s is probably still George Russos, right? Like still George Bell? Like the original inker on Fantastic Four and Golden Age artist. I think he was still coloring right up until the early 80s for Marvel, coloring the covers.
Man, what a career.
As issue 60 opens, Dracula is furious. He's throwing a fit, trashing the whole church, castle, home place. Except, he can't tear down that picture, Jerry.
Nope.
Why? Couldn't he do the old Hulk juggernaut trick of like, well, then I'll destroy the ground underneath it and it will fall.
Yes. Yeah.
Dracula thinks back and recalls his first wife. Dracula hates his first wife, Jerry. He treated her terribly, abused her mentally and physically.
Oh, man.
Cheated on her with married women that then he'd kill. It drove his first wife to suicide. But not before producing Lilith, who then appears in an apparition to taunt him further.
I felt like, before I read this, I felt like I needed more reason to hate Dracula. And Marv Wolfman obliged.
He recalls how Lilith once even tried to starve him to death by, rushing and beating him to the punch to every kill he was going to do and leaving him with nothing.
Yeah.
That's rough. So he's really, feeling the loss of his loved one here. I mean, he also recalls the Turk who killed his second, Maria, who he loved, and how their son was raised by gypsies and hated him and tried to kill him. He had to kill him. Finally, he's just standing at the rooftops in the rain, big lightning storm, just yelling to the gods, saying, all right, just take me now, end it. But instead of ending him, the storm parts and the sky's clear. Dope. He figures, well, he still has Domini, though, right? And with a woman like that by my side, I am unstoppable. Domini, by the way, she's sitting at Janice's grave. It's really eerie. She's talking to the grave as if she'll be seeing Janice again soon as she returns with, the right words to say. Furthermore, she asks Janice not to hate his father or to seek his death. I mean, what is up with this woman? What is her angle?
I don't know. She's a woman that knows things.
Next issue blurb, resurrection. Nuff said, right?
Nuff said.
But wait a minute, Jerry, are we going to have to wait all the way until, Halloween 2021 to find out what happens here?
Fans, if you want to find out what happens, dial 1-900.
If you want Robin to live.
No, no one does.
If you want the Bill Gemas book to go on and not Peter David's Captain Marvel.
I don't know. What do you think? Should we put it out of its misery?
I want to get to these last 10 issues and find out what happens here.
Okay, yeah, let's do it. Yeah.
All right, Fear Not True Believer. About at least. Jerry and I will be back next episode to wrap up the series and this 6-year project with the last 10 issues of this title. And maybe a little surprise.
Oh. Dun, dun, dun.
What do you think of these issues? Like, and like you said, it's resolved that long-standing Deacon Frost bit.
Yeah.
And really further developed kind of what is the big arc of the last 20, 25 issues, the last couple of years of the book, although even more because the book switches back to bi-monthly towards the end as sales are dwindling on it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all this stuff with the cult and the baby and the wife and after reading all of the earlier issues that have more of the done-in-ones and more of the, like, you know, Dracula being chased by the Scoobies and all that stuff, there was something to kind of settling into this long play here and kind of see. I mean, if it pays off, though, you know, I didn't go ahead and cheat and read the ending yet, so I don't know where it goes or how they get there.
Yeah. I think I found myself missing the earlier issues that were kind of Frank Drake centered.
Yeah.
And, you know, telling the story of them pursuing Dracula. That was a little more compelling to me, but I think as a story arc, this Satult thing was probably the most interesting story idea of the whole batch. So I appreciated it for, you know, the Satanic Panic that comes after this. You know, I grew up as a child of that era, so that was fun for me. I don't know. I wish the writing was a little better, and it really did kind of bog down in the center of this chunk, because on either end of that Harold H. Harold issue, there's kind of a recap issue. So you get 3 issues in a row where the plot doesn't really move at all. But still, I mean, like I said before, the art is so good, and it just tickles a part of me that other comics don't do, in a way. You know, I really enjoy reading it. I have no regrets about taking on this read. It's been really fun.
You just like the crossbow bolt in the butt.
That, yeah, okay, you got me. That did make me laugh for a good 10 minutes.
One thing that stood out to these issues, because the earlier issues were more about, like you said, more about Frank Drake and Rachel and those characters, and Dracula was, in some of those issues, as we've said in the past, like kind of more the force of nature that would pass through, where the stories weren't Dracula-centric as they've become here.
Yeah.
But in doing so, Wolfman finally gave his take on what's Dracula's endgame. Like, what is he trying to do?
Yeah.
Is he just trying to survive? And he gave us a pretty plausible world domination strategy that isn't just do it with might.
Right.
And why doesn't he take over the world with a vampire army? Well, that question gets answered too. He's tried in the past, but he couldn't even take over the first throne room because that Janus dude would show up.
Yeah.
So that's interesting, and I think that's everything is Dracula and Lupescu and Domini and now this Janus character, though. That's the dynamic that I want to see, how it stops spinning. Lupescu's been taken out of the picture, but his works remain, right? The cult still exists and everything. So it'll be fun to see how it ends. I know that it ends on a double sized issue that was supposed to be the last three issues crammed into one. That there was some serious editing that had to be done when kind of the writing was on the wall and the book had to end.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it'll be interesting to see how Wolfman ends what ends up being one of his real grand works at Marvel and was considered such a, I'll use the word again, sophisticated, like, adult book for its time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool.
I mean, of all the monster books I've read from Marvel, it's easily the best. I mean, Frankenstein looks great, but this one's the best. There's a reason it ran longer than the rest of them.
It wasn't just that Marv was the writer and editor. I think we'll greenlight another year. It wasn't until Shooter showed up at the end. All right, Jerry, thank you for doing this. I look forward all summer to the opportunity to talk to you about this silly stuff.
Oh, that's crazy, but I appreciate it.
And now we get to do it. If we do do it again, then when we started this segment in 2015, we actually did the first 20 issues over two consecutive episodes.
Uh-huh.
So if we end that way, then we kind of bookend the way we started.
I guess we got to do what we got to do.
All right, so until Harold J. Harold takes over the Boston Globe before becoming mayor of Boston, make mine Marvel. Later.